Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And weaving her way through traffic is the editor of ClassicFilmFan.com and associate professor at La Sierra University, Miss Carrie Specht.
Hey!
And now craning down the street, pedestrians be damned, is the film experience's Anne-Marie Kelly.
Are you talking to me?
Thank you. On today's show, we're going to talk about the 31st movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver is considered by many to be one of the defining films of the 70s, New Hollywood era. Not only was it stylish and formally inventive, it also addressed the loss of innocence of the post-Vietnam era. But we're going to look at it through contemporary eyes and see if it still holds up. Next, we have a shameless piece of clickbait. We're going to talk about who we think are the greatest living American directors. Our last Sight and Sound entry was a Coppola film. This time we have Scorsese. Find out if these two chiefdoms of cinema made our lists. Then we'll wrap things up with a few final notes of positivity. All right, the meter's running. You guys ready?
Yes.
Then let's do it.
Carriage return.
Our first topic is Martin Scorsese's 1976 feature Taxi Driver. The film stars Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle, a recently returned Vietnam vet who suffers from insomnia, and one imagines a whole host of other post-traumatic stress symptoms. To pass the time, Bickle takes a job as a taxi driver, a gig for which he is well-suited because he keeps late hours and is willing to drive anyone to any part of town, no matter how unsavory the character or dangerous the area. Bickle becomes a Karen-esque figure, escorting lost and depraved souls through the hellish landscape of 1970s New York City. He doesn't talk to anyone, preferring instead to hurtle through the city, passing judgment on everything he sees. Despite Bickle's growing contempt for humanity, it's not all bad, at least in the beginning. His beacon of light, his angel, his respite from the scum, is personified by Betsy, played by Cybill Shepherd. In the first act, Bickle convinces Betsy to let him take her out. Things initially seem to go shockingly well, but Bickle's courting ritual ends in disaster when on their first date, he takes her to a porno theater. The other female in Bickle's life, or at least that he thinks is in his life, is Iris, a 12-and-a-half-year-old prostitute, played by Jodie Foster. Iris hops into Bickle's cab one night, but is pulled out by her pimp, Sport, played by Harvey Keitel. After this encounter, he becomes obsessed with rescuing her. Bickle sees himself as a gallant knight, saving Iris from a life of moral and physical debasement, and liberating Betsy from the trappings of middle-class banality. Unfortunately for him, the women aren't all that interested in being rescued. They mostly just see him as the creepy guy silently leering at them from inside a cab. When the world doesn't match up with Bickle's illusions, he turns inward and starts spiraling into violent, paranoid delusions. That's my summary. Do you guys like Taxi Driver? Who wants to go first?
Well, I'll tell you this. I revisited it last night to make sure I remembered it the way I remembered it. And, of course, I didn't. But it reminded me that fashions, whether it's clothing or filmmaking, are cyclical and that this style of filmmaking is popular again. So, in a sense, if this came out today, it's amazing how fresh the cinematography is. Cinematography is absolutely gorgeous. And that sort of slow, steady, non-story that happens, and then you get these little plot points along the way, is very in the hipness right now of independent filmmaking. It comes along every once in a while of this sort of detachment and also sort of a, what is it, a look on American culture, American lifestyles, and the effect it has on those on the fringe. This is something that absolutely I think is very fresh. At the same time, I felt the film was a lot slower in pace than I remember, which is also seems to be a fashion style in filmmaking.
Slow cinema.
Yeah, they purposely, I felt sometimes in the film they took these sidetracks that were like, why are they going there? It seems like unnecessary. But those are my initial thoughts.
Okay.
Anne-Marie? Yeah, do I like the movie? I don't know if I can make a judgment call on that because I don't think it's a movie that you sit down and you're like, ah, you know what? I have a few hours to kill. Yeah. I think I'll put on Taxi Driver and just relax. It's an intense experience to watch. It's watching Travis Bickle slowly unravel and then not so slowly unravel is uncomfortable and distasteful at times experience.
Yeah, you cannot have this simply on in the background
No.
while you're cleaning the house.
No, it's not. It's that's actually the first time I watched it on my own just because I was like, I'm a Scorsese fan and I've somehow always missed this movie, so I should sit down and check it out. And I remember like doing the very college student thing, which is I put the movie on, I checked Facebook, I took my phone out, I, you know, started getting distracted, and I remember like slowly closing Facebook and then turning off my phone because I got so engrossed in the grossness of the movie. But this is a movie that demands that kind of attention from you, and it grabs it from you. I rewatched it to revisit it too because there was a lot that I hadn't thought about with it for a while, and I was struck by not only how consistent Scorsese is as a filmmaker. Like, you can watch his movies and be like, this is definitely a Scorsese film. But also how influenced it was by films before it and how much, like you were saying, it's a cyclical thing, how much I can see other movies drawing themes, characters, shots, etc., from Taxi Driver as well.
Mm. Yeah.
For the worse and for the better.
Sure. So when I first saw this, probably in college, I loved it. I adored it. And I totally related to Travis Bickle.
That's a little scary.
I know. Isn't that terrifying?
Something you need to tell us.
But actually, watching this movie now, it kind of reminds me of Catcher in the Rye, where depending on how old you are and where you are in your life, the character is either totally relatable or totally alienating. Because they are both such strong first-person narratives. And they both have this very specific point of view, and they both capture it, this very specific loneliness and isolation and feeling of being, you know, like feeling like nobody understands you and feeling both above the fray and feeling like you want to belong and can't quite relate to other people. But what plays as profound and insightful at 18 may not play that way when you're a little bit older. And I think that's the case for, I think that that's the case for both Taxi Driver and something like Catcher in the Rye. And I think both authors, both Scorsese and Salinger, are very aware of the mind, the psyche that they're trying to capture. And now that I'm a grown-up, I understand that perhaps you need better idols than Travis Bickle.
Oh, maybe a few.
Yeah. But I don't know. When I first saw it, like, I totally was able to just look past the obvious misogyny and racism and homophobia and just totally focus on the angsty part of the movie.
Well, and his independence and going his own path and doing what he wants, saying what he wants, living the way he wants.
Right, Well, there's something about feeling, like I said, isolated and both above the fray, but also really also wanting to belong that is so associated with youthful alienation that I, like I said, I was didn't pay much attention to the fact that he's a crazy person.
He's a psychopath.
He's a psychopath. He's absolutely a psychopath. Yeah, it's a total young man's movie. And I get the feeling like young men, and I guess some young women, apparently, like the movie for the wrong reasons.
So this is what I wanted to talk about, because this is what I kept thinking about during the movie. Paul Schrader, the writer, has talked about how he thought he was writing a movie about loneliness, but he found out while he was writing it that he was writing about the pathology of loneliness. And the two movies that I thought of the most while I was watching it was The Searchers, which is another movie about a man who is maybe
a little pathological
and saving
and
a woman
obsessed.
Who probably doesn't actually want to be saved.
Right.
And then Fight Club, which is another movie about a guy who thinks he's above the fray and is going to change the world in all of the awful ways of, you know, violence and destruction and the rest of it. So my thoughts were twofold on it. One, do you think that like we just need a pathologically lonely person movie per decade?
Per generation.
Per generation. In which case, we might be due because Fight Club was 99. And the other part is, how much do you think the movie criticizes or condones what Travis Bickle does? Because in The Searchers, there's a subtle vein of not of condemning what John Wayne's character is doing.
Right.
And I think in Taxi Driver there is as well, but there's not in Fight Club. Like, Fight Club is glorifying that hyper-masculinized right. violence.
Or if so. It is, it's too subtle to be detected, or it's too easily to ignore it.
Yes.
Yes. I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. It's almost a separate topic, but mm-hmm. something like the movie Her,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a isolated young man movie in many ways.
Of course.
But I think that is considerably more fair to women and also less tolerant of it's not as interested in indulging him. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting comparison. But there's something very uniquely 1970s about the way that city life and you know, urbanization or whatever is portrayed. Just as
the real dirty, gritty, ugly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I guess is kind of replicated, and that itself is romanticized in Fight Club, where like symbols of modernity and comfort and, you know, femininity are seen as just commercial and disgusting, and grittiness is seen as, you know, a return to, I don't know, whatever that it is that Tyler Durden is advocating or Edward Norton's character mm-hmm. is advocating. But it's a good question. Is, like we said, just because they are portraying something doesn't necessarily mean it is an endorsement. Mm-hmm. But maybe we should talk about, like, specific ways that he might be romanticizing this point of view.
Well, I don't know if Schrader or Scorsese are romanticizing the character of Travis Bickle. Well, I think they more likely are doing as addressing post-traumatic stress syndrome mm-hmm. before there was a word for it or before it was talked about regularly in specific terms. I mean, he does say what, 3 years earlier, the film comes out in 76. In the film, he says he was honorably discharged in 73.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 3 years later. What's interesting to me is I'm wondering, well, where has he been?
Mm-hmm.
And they never address that. The interesting thing about the film is there's a definite beginning, middle, and end. We see him applying for the job as a taxi driver.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where the heck was he before this?
Right.
You know,
the only thing that we know about it beforehand is that he couldn't sleep is the only thing
right.
that we know.
Well, and in one of the letters that he's narrating, that he's writing to his parents, he says something about, I can't tell you where I'm living now, just like before.
Right.
Okay, where was before? I think it's really, really well done.
Mm-hmm.
We never sit there beleaguered with the idea of like, oh my gosh, where did he come from? Where did he come from? We just accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's enough of a hint to suggest, was he in perhaps a military hospital
mm-hmm.
the whole time, or a vet's hospital, or some kind of care facility?
Is he a vet at all?
Yeah, we get shots of...
Ah.
Well, I mean, we get shots of his military jacket, which mm-hmm. has
his name
on
the back.
And when he's doing push-ups, you actually see scars on his back.
Yeah,
so he's definitely been somewhere and had
yeah, I never questioned that, but
him.
That's interesting to bring up that question.
Yeah. You can buy an army jacket at a surplus store, right?
I don't know if you spray paint your name on it, though.
That's, yeah.
Well, is his name really Travis Bickle?
That's true. He does give a fake name to the FBI or that's Secret
right.
Service agent.
Yeah. Everything in this movie is totally unreliable. There's so much first-person POV shot. There's so many POV shots. Almost everything is through the eyes of Travis Bickle.
Yeah, it hugs close to his perspective.
Exactly. So virtually the entire movie is, I mean, who knows what, if anything, we're seeing is actually happening.
Well, right. That brings up the ending, which is the most confounding part of the entire movie to me specifically, because he goes on the rampage, has the entire, you know, bloody showdown, and then we cut
spoiler.
To... anyway, so we go through this whole, like, denouement. It looks like it's basically wrapped up with him dying or being shot by the police or something, but mm-hmm. instead we get this tacked-on epilogue of, you know, panning across all of the newspaper clippings, calling him a hero all of a sudden.
And the narrated letter from Iris's father.
Yes, the narrated letter from Iris's father. And then even beyond that, we get the scene of...
him being a taxi driver again, which doesn't make any sense to me.
and his blonde angel comes back and sits in the back of the car and looks at him more admiringly than she has for the entirety of the movie.
Yeah.
And just because of the way it was shot, with him looking into the back, into the mirror, like never actually turning around and looking at her, only seeing her through the perspective of the mirror, clearly with a wind fan in front of her and lit, it made me wonder how much of this is actually happening. Mm-hmm. Like, did he just die on the couch next to sobbing Iris? Did he die in a coma? Like, how much of that section of it is real? And then by extension, how much of what we've seen beforehand has been?
Right. It's kind of the usual suspects kind of ending where the twist sort of nullifies everything you've seen beforehand.
I wouldn't say nullifies, complicates.
I think it's interesting. For me, I almost felt like the ending was this American guy who had gone off and served his country finally got the recognition he was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
That he didn't necessarily want to date her. He didn't want a romance. But the fact that she acknowledged him for the hero that he became or that the media made him out to be,
mm-hmm.
and that he felt he was... It was enough for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he does look out the side. You do see a shot of him looking out the side door. You don't see it. It's not from her point of view.
Right.
But he does look out the side mirror, and he's got this smile on his face. And it's, okay, is that a smile of satisfaction, or is this a smirk of a sociopath? Either way. But I got the sense that this finally he was like, okay, I'm good.
Interesting. I'd always, I think from the first time I saw it, interpreted the last sequence as just either some sort of purgatory or a hallucination, but it's interesting to think about how, you know, we see the newspaper clippings, and maybe it's an indictment of how the news media covers incidents like these. And
oh, well, yeah, because if he had shot the politician,
he
would have been vilified, but because he shoots a pimp and a John, he's a hero, which.
Right.
To me, that the slow pan showing those clips, that's what it was to me.
Mm.
That these press clippings would be really different had he actually succeeded in what he was trying to do in the first place.
That's actually really interesting. But I still... that does complicate that matters because... But it seems so unlikely that he would live, and that seems so far-fetched. And the way that last scene is shot with Cybill Shepherd in the back, with just her floating head, it does seem very ethereal
and
dreamlike.
Well, he's very detached from the real world.
That's true. The most important, in going back earlier to one of the earlier conversations that he has with his taxi driver comrades, the most important shot in that entire diner sequence is not of whatever they're talking about, which I actually can't even remember off the top of my head. It's the fact that he notices the pimp in the corner and he's making eye contact with the pimp and like visibly upset by the existence of this person in the diner, not even caring what's going on with the other people who ostensibly he's there to meet.
Yeah. And again, that the fact that he only sees the pimp in the corner speaks to his point of view, and
I would say alleged pimp.
But we don't know for sure.
Right.
That is true. But
the man does look like Superfly.
it's true. But the way that we see New York, we see the world, is entirely through Bickle's perspective. And so I thought we could talk about the portrayal of New York City and why it's set there as opposed to Los Angeles, which is where it was originally supposed to be set, or it was going to be set.
The practical reason is that there are just more taxi drivers
in
New York.
That is the alleged reason why.
Well, I think also isn't – I could be wrong, but, I mean, obviously Scorsese is a New York director.
Right.
I think Paul Schrader is an L.A. writer.
Mm-hmm.
So – but once Scorsese got on board, it's like, dude, I make movies in New York.
Right, right. But what does New York symbolize that – L.A. does not, or vice versa?
It doesn't. I mean, New York has always symbolized commerce, you know, the American way. And
this is
America today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got these politicians who are trying to be upright and straight, and they're almost made comical.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the real grittiness that's happening in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got these people who are caught in between. How can they not go a little crazy?
Mm-hmm.
I think the use of New York is really important for it too, because LA is mostly a blank slate. But what was happening at the time in the 70s with gentrification of people moving out of the cities is that places like Times Square, which had been this important, you know, New York landmark, everyone knew it, had fallen into being, well, what Travis sees in the movie. And so I like it as just like a little note of history to be like, yes, remember Times Square used to be terrible and people were afraid of going there. It's mm-hmm. what Midnight Cowboy is kind of about too. But it's really using New York as a background for Travis's
psychological state.
Mm-hmm. But also by extension, making it less of a personal statement and making it more broad and mm-hmm. Applying the personal problems that Travis has to larger themes for post-Vietnam America.
Yeah.
L.A. sort of symbolizes glitziness and glamour, and then historically we've made movies about what lies beneath the sheen, the gloss of Hollywood and the glamour and whatnot. But New York, it's in films, it's like there is a grittiness to New York. I don't know if it's still there, but that's the way that's sort of the mythos of that place. And in this film, it's real, the grittiness and the trashiness is really played up, whereas 3 years later we get Woody Allen's Manhattan, which is probably one of the most famous love letters to that mm-hmm. city.
Yeah.
So Manhattan and New York City can really represent whatever you want it to. It can be, you can highlight the grittiness and the disgusting aspects.
Well, it's a melting pot, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or you can, you know, emphasize it's the beauty of the architecture, and as gritty and harsh as I'm sure city life in the 1970s was, there were real people living there, and yes, there was crime, but it's sort of, people look back nostalgically on that era now.
On the 1970s era?
Yeah,
yeah, people
of New York, yeah.
It's not New York anymore.
Yeah.
It's not the grime
in
New York.
Yeah.
But I think even in the 1970s, it likely was not as disgusting as Bickle makes it out to be.
Yeah, he's drawn to very specific...
Like, he's looking for the scum.
Yeah.
I think it likely was much more dangerous, much far more illegal activities happening out in the open. But there were also normal people living their lives. But Bickle doesn't see that. The camera is focused on...
Yeah, but that's, I think, also the normal people living their lives were the ones who were able to shut it out completely. Mm-hmm. They're living amongst it, but they're able to shut it out. Bickle, I think, represents the people, almost an awakening, going, why are we shutting this out? Mm-hmm. Why is everybody closing their eyes to this?
Mm-hmm.
And he's not only incapable of doing it, but wouldn't want to.
Confrontation with the politician in the back of his car when he says, yes. I drive in taxis so that I can meet the real people. It's like, well, here's a guy who cleans blood out of the back seat of his car every day. This is
more.
Real people. And more. So you want this is about as real as you're going to get. And then, mm-hmm. of course, like Bickle goes unhinged in that entire speech. But
And the politician's reaction was kind of like, at first the politician's aide is like, oh, this is awesome, this is great, he's meeting people, at least that's the look on his face.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, it's kind of like there's a silence from the politician, and you get this sense of, okay, this guy's a nut, you know. But it's like, dude, you asked for reality, he gave you reality, and you can't handle it, and you want to sweep it under the rug.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, that whole sequence, that was so surreal, because most of the time Bickle is so hesitant to say anything, and he just sort of goes off. It made me think like that's probably one of his delusions.
I don't know. They had to coax it out of him.
I don't know. Like, it seemed like the chances that a person running for president would hop into Travis Bickle's cab, it's like so unlikely and preposterous that it made me think like that whole sequence was an illusion. Also, yeah, just the chattiness, like the way he interacted with Palatine was so unlike how he interacts with
not necessarily
everyone else.
Though he has this habit of like being very quiet for long periods of time and then finding one person, focusing on that one person, and then giving them far too much. He does it with Iris, he does it
with Betsy,
he does it with the Secret Service agent, he does it with Palatine. Like
he even does it with sport.
Exactly. He does these it's like every time he tries to connect, he always goes too far.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm just kind of convinced the whole thing is a dream.
I've gotten that impression, yeah.
I was totally unclear on that.
Let's talk about the performances.
Have we been?
I know, yeah. But I feel like we should gush a little bit. De Niro is pretty fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
This is De Niro at his prime. But,
well, it, you know, and my husband says this a lot. It's like you can tell a great performance when you can't imagine anybody else in the role. And mm-hmm. that's so true about this role. You can't imagine anybody else pulling off Travis Bickle. But, yeah, he's pretty amazing. And I think everybody in this film is really Absolutely. At their height of abilities, whether it's a tiny, tiny role like Keitel. I mean, such a small role. Mm-hmm. Albert Brooks, really small role. Mm-hmm. Sybil Shepherd has never been better.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Probably true. But, yeah, and Jodie Foster. Baby Jodie.
Oh, my gosh,
but
baby Jodie.
Kind of baby Jodie, but she is...
It's her transition point.
I mean, she's, what, 13 years old?
12
years old.
She was 12 when she made it.
The way we judge child performances is so different from the way we judge adult performances. Like, it's either the child got a pretty close approximation to an actual human child, or they're just really precocious and lovable. Mm-hmm. But Jodie Foster is an adult.
That yeah, she's an adult in the time. Yeah. Between yeah. her and Harvey Keitel when they're dancing is one of the creepiest, most uncomfortable, amazing scenes I've mm-hmm. ever seen.
It's one of, I think, two scenes in the entire movie that isn't Travis-centric. And right. I think it's also a really important scene just so that, because we've been seeing Iris mostly through Travis' perspective. And obviously Travis has this like white knight idea of what he's going to help Iris with. But she's been attempting through the entire thing to act very adult-like. And she does to a certain degree because of what she does and because of how good Jodie Foster's performance is. She does seem very adult in how she speaks, what she says she's doing, the control she speaks to having over her life. But in this scene, you see how manipulative he is and how yes. much she needs him yeah. or thinks she needs him.
Yeah.
And it's, I think that's what's part of what makes it so uncomfortable and so real is seeing her basically become a highly sexualized little kid mm-hmm. in that scene. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, by the way, one other performance we should mention is yes. Martin Scorsese's performance yes. in the back of the cab.
Oh, pretty good actor.
Was crazy good.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Man had a calling if he yes. hadn't become a world-famous director.
Yeah. She could really have just into that.
Played.
Should start going on auditions. So speaking of Scorsese, I thought we could maybe talk about where this film fits into his
oeuvre.
Thank you. Well, when in doubt, go with the French
right
word.
After Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore and right before Raging Bull?
No, there were several between Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. Like he okay. did King of Comedy, did New York, New York.
Okay.
I actually prefer King of Comedy as a film.
I do too.
It's one that I'd like to watch again yes. more than like I as much as I admire Taxi Driver, I feel like I can put it away for another 8 years or so and
yeah,
maybe revisit it.
I don't think I have to ever watch it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're good.
Yeah. Of course, I'm older than you, but...
Yeah. Scorsese is someone who is very well-versed in cinema history. And like we said, there's a very, very direct influence. Like, we see the Ford illusions in the story.
Mm-hmm.
But in the camera work, did you notice, like, any callbacks or, like... to me, it doesn't seem like self-consciously quoting other movies. It's more just incorporating other things, it feels like, but it has very specific point of view.
There's one shot that is a direct callback, and I can't remember the name of the movie. It's the shot where he's looking into the bubbles in the glass.
Right, one or two things I know about her, the Godard movie.
Yes, that's what it was.
There was that one shot that... But both me and my husband were kind of like, "What the heck is that?" He's on the payphone, and we've got his mm-hmm. his back to the camera. We're on the payphone. We're there. Suddenly, the camera moves unmotivated mm-hmm. away from him and looks down that hall.
Mm-hmm.
We continue to hear his conversation off screen, and then finally, he comes in. And we're like, "Okay, this really brought attention to the camera. What the heck was that about?"
Mm-hmm. I was just about to talk about that.
Good, good.
Because that one felt very, I don't know, Fellini-esque to me, but because it was like, hello, camera, there's a camera here. Yeah, and Fellini loves doing that. But also because it's one of the few moments when the camera feels empathetic towards Travis. Because what that phone call that he's on is when he's trying to get another date with Betsy after taking her to a porno movie. Like, of course she's not going to go on a third date. But it's such an uncomfortable scene. Like, he almost resorts to begging, or at least the closest that Travis ever gets to begging. And it felt like the camera moving away from him was almost like, this is just give him a private moment, let him finish his phone call, and then he walks back in, the kind of the movie proceeds. But with that and with the slow motion shots, those are the two times that I think the camera gets closest emotionally to Travis. I think for the most part, otherwise you can, like, there are so many shots from high above.
Like those God shots.
The God shots and the rest of it. That I think that those few spare moments are important for, like, just kind of being an emotional touchstone for those who are going to empathize with him and for those who aren't, actually. Because I think getting that close to his perspective in those various parts is part of what makes the movie uncomfortable.
Well, I also felt, I mean, looking back at it now, at the time I didn't get it, but thinking about it, I thought it's also a separation.
Mm-hmm.
You have just been watching one film. Now mm-hmm. we're going to go on with a different film.
Yeah.
That seemed like a definite break. Like, okay, we're done with this story. We're going to go on with this story. It happens to include all the same characters.
Right.
But it's a different story now. And those God shots that you talked about, I noticed, I don't know if you guys noticed this, I thought it was a very similar shot to Dial In for Murder, mm-hmm. where the lead actor in that film is talking to the guy who he wants to kill his wife, and you see it from above, mm-hmm. and it's like a floor plan, right?
Yeah.
And then at the end of the film, when we're going over those press clippings, in the press had laid out some of the floor plans.
Yeah.
So in a way, that shot's like a crime scene mm-hmm. investigation before the crime scene mm-hmm. investigation begins.
Other movie that Scorsese cited as being an influence on this film is Hitchcock's The Wrong Man.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that it really brought to mind for me was Spellbound, especially with that point of view shot with the gun where he's looking, apparently aiming his weapon at people on the street,
mm-hmm.
and it's like moving. Just it reminded me of that great shot in Spellbound where... Yeah.
I made a hand gesture. Yes, yeah. I don't know why I made a hand gesture. Because
it's good for radio.
Exactly.
But if you've seen Spellbound, I think you know the shot where the gun turns towards the camera. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously it's not just visual elements that recall Hitchcock. He's his Bernard Herrmann as the composer.
Yes.
And if you watch through the end of the credits, the three notes at the end are the same three notes as the beginning of Psycho credits.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But apparently Bernard Herrmann thinks Travis Bickle's a psycho. but yeah, I mean, Scorsese, we are all just kind of an amalgamation of our different influences, but he has this way of using what he knows and finding a way to make it his own, to put his own stamp on it. So that's one of the reasons why people adore him so much, I imagine. But people may adore Scorsese, but is this the film? This is his top-ranked film on the Sight and Sound list.
Wow, this is ranked higher than Raging Bull?
It is, yes. Wow. Yes, the 31st spot on the Sight and Sound list.
We just exchanged this very, like, really? Like, so I have a feeling you know what we're going to say next.
Yes. So do you think that Taxi Driver is worthy of the 31st spot on the Sight and Sound list?
I do not.
Okay. Why?
I think 31's high. It seems high to me.
Mm.
I would have ranked it more in the 60s. I mean, I have to take a look at all the other films and so on and so forth, but I think Raging Bull should rank higher than Taxi Driver.
Fair enough. Anne-Marie?
Well, now I'm trying to think about it because I think that Raging Bull is a better film, but now I'm wondering, considering how much more Taxi Driver has invaded pop culture or influenced pop culture.
That's true.
I'm wondering if that earns it its higher place mm-hmm. than Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think more American filmmakers have emulated Taxi Driver than Raging Bull.
Well, for many, I think the main reason is that Raging Bull's in black and white. Yeah. And only in the last, 5 years has black and white suddenly become an option again to use legitimately.
Yeah, yeah. But there's something about, there's something so youthful and, like, exuberant about the way the movie's cut. But, yeah, there's, like, that new wave, the total, like, incorporating of new wave ethos and neorealism, just the way that all the coolest elements of European cinema are injected into this very uniquely American story. I don't know if it's worthy of the 31st spot. I mean, there are so many movies that I personally rank above it, but I can't deny its significance or its influence in film history. So I guess 31's a good spot for it. Why not?
I retract my previous statement.
All right. No, it's fine if you think it should be in the 60s.
No, your argument was really strong and valid.
All right, then. I'll take it. Last time, Carrie Ann Marie and I did a podcast together. It was for the previous Sight and Sound entry, The Godfather Part 2. Before we started recording, Carrie casually mentioned that she thinks that Francis Ford Coppola is the greatest living American filmmaker. Now, I have a tendency to overthink, well, everything. So ever since she said that, I've been trying to figure out who I think is the greatest living American director. And I've come up with a list of a few people, different options, and the rest of us have as well. And so we plan to settle this matter once and for all. So how did you pick Francis Ford Coppola? What makes him the greatest living American filmmaker, Carrie?
His body of work.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. His body of work, I think, stands for itself.
Okay.
Yeah, both as a scriptwriter and a director.
Mm-hmm.
So an auteur,
yes.
I suppose.
Yes.
For me, that was the defining factor.
Okay, so just the sheer number of really good movies that he's made or worked on.
Yeah, and I mean, I believe there's a huge amount of quality in every one of his films, but yes.
I don't know. So I had a hard time. I was totally wrestling with this question for many days after you said that. And I thought to myself, like, what are the factors that go into deciding something like that? And I know this is some tangent that my brain goes on, and it's like some mental exercise that I'm totally just indulging in because I enjoy doing stuff like that. But I dissected every part of that statement. I was like, what does it mean to be an specifically American director? Is Francis Ford Coppola a specifically American director? Well, kind of. Like, the Godfather series is one of the most acclaimed American films, and it is specifically about America.
Mm-hmm.
And so, is that a factor in determining whether or not a filmmaker is the greatest living American director?
It's funny because I was actually just thinking about it as nationality.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you're saying is absolutely true.
Yeah.
You should consider this what qualifies, quantifies American.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be an American? Like, is it just that you're born in America? Because like Hitchcock's Hollywood movies, I'd say, are very American in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But he is not an American filmmaker.
Nor is he living.
Yes. He's just totally disqualified.
I didn't know he was sick.
Oh, man, Hitchcock died?
That was my pick. But, Anne-Marie, what were some of the things that you considered when making this decision?
I struggled with that, too, of the how you define what makes somebody a peculiarly American director, like, as opposed to whatever else. And then I just started writing down names of directors I respect and want to see. Part of the problem, too, is that we've got a lot of directors now who are still alive who aren't making any more movies.
That's true, yeah.
I also wrote down three names, realized that they were British, and had to cross them off.
Well, that's so who are the British ones?
Edgar Wright and Jane Campion.
Okay,
Jane Campion's from New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah.
And Edgar Wright is amazing.
Right. Yeah, Campion, she works with so many American actors.
But her movies are very specifically New Zealand, and then Bright Star is very British.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, my list right now has on it, and feel free to, you know, talk or disagree on any of these directors' names, because I just started throwing out names of American directors that I really respect, are Kathryn Bigelow, Todd Haynes, Linklater, Eastwood, and Soderbergh.
Okay, yeah.
as well as Scorsese and Coppola, obviously. Like,
right.
Are we allowed to say Scorsese and Coppola anymore? They're like the titans of everything.
No, I think that, like, the list wouldn't be complete without considering
them. It's funny because I think a lot of people leave them off list because they think of them as being this a galaxy director.
Yeah. And at this point, I think of Spielberg more as a producer than a director. And okay. I think he's actually a better producer than director.
Like, really?
Just by sheer amount of work and the fact that he produced The Animaniacs.
But it's a single greatest achievement.
I actually said greatest American filmmaker. Yeah. So producers would fall under that realm.
I have to go back to my list.
keep calling.
He has an ability to get stuff made that I think needs to get made. And mm-hmm. I really respect that as a producer.
Yeah. So I have a long list. So I have put Martin Scorsese. This is my top five. Earl Morris, just because I think we need a documentarian. There's several. Steve James, I think he's a really great filmmaker. And I don't think any movie made me cry harder than Life Itself last year. So, and Frederick Wiseman, still making movies.
Really?
Yeah. He just did National Gallery last year.
Mm-hmm.
For me, but it's always like the choice between like, do I go with the filmmaker who's had the greatest impact on cinema, or do I go with the ones that I think are my personal favorites?
Mm-hmm.
So someone like Richard Linklater is a favorite of mine, but I don't know what impact he's had on.
Yeah, see, that's the other part.
Right.
I think I keep bringing my husband up this episode. But anyway, we were having discussion about greatest living, you know, directors, and he kept mentioning some great filmmakers. But I said, but they're not old enough.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't done their full body of work, and you haven't really seen the impact of their work or their influence of their work on young filmmakers yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of it. You know,
right.
Just as you were saying, how Taxi Driver has influenced more filmmakers and films than Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
I think the same could be said for Coppola and Scorsese, as opposed to a younger filmmaker who is doing great stuff,
mm-hmm.
but they're still in their prime. So,
mm-hmm.
and here's the thing too, test of time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff may have a lot of impact now, even say in the last 10 years or 20. I think you need more time than that to reflect upon, well, what is their footprint?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually why I would not include Tarantino on this list.
Mm. Because he's still too young and he only has, what, six films, seven films?
Six films, seven films. I think Pulp Fiction will continue to be talked about. I don't think any of his other films will.
Interesting.
That's, you know, it's funny. I love Reservoir Dogs, but you're right. People forget about it, and people are far more influenced, and there was much more of an impact with Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I just don't see the rest of his films having, like, they have immediate resonance in the moment that you, like, everybody becomes a Tarantino fan and goes wildly nuts for everything that he's done.
Right.
But they're almost immediately forgettable, and I think it's just because of the way that he makes films. Like, he's a pastiche director.
Mm-hmm.
He grabs very obvious allusions to a lot of other things, and so they rarely rise above what they're referencing.
Right.
And so I think people just kind of forget about
right.
them. And so, yeah, Tarantino made his whole little speech for himself when he won that Academy Award for,
Screenplay.
For right. screenplay. And he was like, my films will stand the test of time. This is proof that I am, like, an auteur. And I was like, yeah, I think it's a proof that in the moment people really liked this film. And
yeah.
we really need to get a better idea of what
he
originals.
Said that?
Oh, my gosh. His
wow, I don't remember
Oscar
that.
Speech was the most self-serving thing I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Like, in a ceremony of self-congratulation, it was the most self-congratulatory, like, this is proof that my characters are real, that people
this
will believe
proof.
In them. And I was like, no, it's proof that people
proof
like you right
now. This is
proof
because about 2,000 people voted an award for me.
Yeah.
2,000 people out of the entire United States and the world.
So the short version of it, that's why I wouldn't include it. Whereas I think that right now, we're, like, Linklater had his brief moment in the sun, and hopefully he'll have more. But just by virtue of the experiments that he's doing and that a lot of, I know, upcoming directors are starting to talk about, I think that Linklater will have more of an impact
right.
later just because he's the guy who's experimenting.
Right. Mm-hmm. And with Quentin Tarantino, it is, I don't think his films are going to have much of an impact beyond the fact that they're very, very popular among the film school set. So,
very specific part of the film school.
Perhaps, yes. But I don't know. It's very disheartening to see how popular he was. Not that I don't enjoy his films, because I absolutely do. They're fun. But it seemed to me that there was more interest in watching his movies than watching the movies that he was
influenced by.
Yeah, exactly. And as you said, it is just pastiche, and it almost becomes like the snake eating its own tail thing. Like, eventually, you're not going to have movies to copy if you don't if you aren't consuming new films, if you don't have that understanding of film history. So I think Tarantino is good at what he does. He's mm-hmm. very, very good at what he does. But I don't necessarily think his impact is a positive one. So in that regard, I don't think that's partially why I didn't put him on my list.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone like P.T. Anderson, who his influences seem very, you know, they seem to be appear to be on his sleeve. He wears them, you know, pretty consciously, self-consciously. But again, I think like Scorsese, the influences are there; they're apparent. But I think he has his own style, his own very.
So who
distinct
else is on
style.
Your list?
Yeah, who else is on your list?
I have a big long list here.
That's
but,
great.
well, I think James Cameron is one of the greatest living American filmmakers. Personally, but that's a personal.
If we're talking about influence, yeah, absolutely. He's
yeah.
part of that wave of the blockbuster movie, and he did it well.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, as we have been discussing, it's not always done well.
But yeah, so P.T. Anderson didn't quite make the cut just because I wanted to make room for Scorsese, who.
wanted to make room for Scorsese?
I thought maybe I'd like slot him in, you know.
Wow. Is Wes Anderson on your list?
Wes Anderson is number 7, but there's something about Anderson that seems very European to me. He's American, but his sensibilities strike me as more European, so I didn't put him on my list.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put him on the list. I think he's a great filmmaker, but I think he makes Wes Anderson films. And unless all of a sudden we start getting a lot of Wes Anderson-like films,
yeah.
I don't see him like influencing a new generation necessarily.
Really? Because I think that a lot of current filmmakers are very directly influenced by Wes Anderson. That sort of the
okay.
preciousness, the attention to detail, like Jason Reitman, I think, is pretty heavily influenced.
Yeah, that's actually
like,
a good
right.
point. That's
yeah.
true.
So... But, like, again, but there's something, there doesn't seem to be anything especially American about him.
I don't know.
Besides his birth?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it is like.
But who's
what
to
does it mean?
That
right.
Maybe this might redefine.
Right.
What
does
an
it mean
American
to be American?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is where my brain went. Like, what does it mean to be an American?
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm thinking of that Greenwood song.
I am too.
Oh, no.
But tacking on to your point, part of the reason I added Catherine Bigelow to my list was for the same reason that you put James Cameron on the list, or the same reason that I agreed with you putting James Cameron on the list, which is the influence of a well-made action film, which is, I think we could agree, at least one of the dominant genres right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right, but do we want to just consider passing dominant genres or just darn good films?
Yeah. In some ways, Cameron and Bigelow are kind of retrograde. Like
Hurt Locker is so overrated.
I like
it did not deserve to be Best Picture.
Oh, I like that movie a lot.
I liked it. It just didn't deserve to be Best Picture.
I think that the style that Bigelow and Cameron have, where you can actually see the action and like the spatial awareness, that's sort of passé. Like it's all about that immersive editing style now, which I'm not a huge fan of. Like the Cameron is very classical in his filmmaking.
Well, and see, there you go. Are we talking about for consistent? See throughout the decades of great American filmmakers, is it going to be more along the classical
mm-hmm.
Hollywood style of filmmaking, or are we talking about people who are influencing or both?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
people who forge their own paths but mixed with classical Hollywood filmmaking.
Right.
I think that's kind of what it's about
mm-hmm.
in
yeah.
regards to being a great American filmmaker.
Yeah. I guess then, so the top two for
mm-hmm.
me. My favorite, my personal favorite living filmmaker, Joel and Ethan Coen.
Hmm, okay.
I will watch every Coen Brothers movie that comes out. I think they're geniuses.
You're right. It's almost an event
yeah.
when they have
yeah.
a film come
yeah.
out.
I was talking with my mentor, film professor, Joseph McBride, about, you know, why are there no Billy Wilders anymore? Like, there's no... There just seems to be a lack of sophistication in the dialogue these days. Meh, kids.
Get off my lawn.
But he corrected me and said, you know, I think the Coen brothers are very Wilder-esque, that very dark, comical style.
It's funny. I hadn't thought about that before, but Barton Fink.
Yeah,
totally. I could see.
And that's your partner.
Yeah, I could totally see Billy Wilder doing both those films.
Yeah.
Oh, he's playing the interview. Playing the interview.
So, I mean, that as far as personal preference goes, they're probably tops. But as far as overall impact, I don't, like, my parents will be shocked to hear me say this, but I think number one has to be Steven Spielberg. I don't think there's anyone who's had a greater impact on Hollywood filmmaking, contemporary filmmaking, than Steven Spielberg.
Okay,
for better or for worse.
If we're just talking sheer impact, then it's Lucas.
Okay.
Then it's George Lucas, because Star Wars changed everything.
That's true. That's true. But he's such a crappy filmmaker.
The guy can't direct. He cannot direct.
Did I say that?
We were all thinking it.
Yeah. I totally agree, but I can't. I don't want to give him that mantle. I don't know. Like, those movies are so bad because he hasn't made very many movies.
No,
he's worked as a producer on a lot of things. But as far as, like, movies that he's directed. American Graffiti and the first Star Wars
movie. Which is considered a seminal film.
Sure, sure. But, yeah, I don't. Yes. And no. But you think more than Steven Spielberg?
Star Wars changed everything.
Yeah.
Star Wars changed an entire business model for an industry.
That's true. But for... not in a good way.
But I don't know if that would make him the greatest living American filmmaker.
Yeah.
Perhaps maybe entrepreneur in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Businessman.
Sure.
Yeah. But as a filmmaker?
Yeah. Carrie, do you have any other filmmakers that you'd like to add? I know... there's only one that really matters.
Yeah, you know, I will concede there's a huge, strong argument to be made for Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
But in regards to greatest living American filmmakers, I really think we have to look at the elder statesmen who were so with, like, if Altman were still alive.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Dennis Altman.
But, you know, all of this has only come out, you know, probably after I'm dead, you know, in regards to the filmmakers that we're discussing now. And their impact and their influences and the value of their art. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this happens. For all we know, it's going to be somebody like, you know, Fincher.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, he didn't come up on any of our lists, huh?
No.
Yeah.
And so he's got some amazing stuff.
Yeah,
that he's done.
I think it's because there are three ladies sitting here. I think had there been a boy, like, Fincher would have come up.
Well, and I tend to forget his more recent stuff. I tend to think of his older stuff, you know? I'm one of those people that believes that there's no such thing as an instant classic, that's an oxymoron, that you really have to have time and distance to judge anything. So there may be the greatest American filmmaker we know who has, like, a film out right now, but we're not going to realize the impact of that person until 40, 50 years has gone by.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also nobody mentioned Spike Lee.
Right, and that's probably a huge oversight. We should probably.
Well, and he's obviously influential and been influenced, and that's a great mixture. A filmmaker who has not only been influenced by previous filmmakers, but is making influences or impacts.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a self-aware camera.
Mm.
You know, when we were talking earlier about Scorsese's two shots in Taxi Driver, well, Spike Lee was a student of Scorsese, and it just dawned on me while we were talking that every film that he makes, there's a very self-conscious camera move.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that was an influence from Scorsese when he was his instructor.
Mm-hmm.
That makes total sense to me, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, there's all sorts of people that we didn't mention, and there will be people out there going, my gosh, I can't believe they didn't mention so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. Woody Allen. Exactly. And for all we know, Woody Allen may be hailed as the greatest American filmmaker. And time and history has a tendency to forget the politicalness of a person's life.
Mm-hmm.
Any filmmaker,
yeah,
you look back and their personal lives usually are kind of messed up in one way or another. So anyway, some people might say one of the greatest filmmakers ever was Orson Welles, and yet his body of work is extremely slim. But they say Citizen Kane is one of the most impactful films.
Now you're goading me here.
Yeah, sorry.
It's good because we wanted to continue pick up our argument from last time.
We don't have time to pick up your argument from last time.
To be.
Yeah, this is almost ongoing discussion. But anyway, my point is just that it's going to take a lot of time and distance before any choices from the living directors really are firmly established. I believe that both. I'll say this, that Spielberg, Coppola, and Scorsese have absolutely totally earned a spot. I can't believe there's anything they're going to do to lose that spot. Mm-hmm. The only reason I don't mention Lucas is because I feel like he's really more of a businessman.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally fine with that distinction. Yeah. I feel like I may have accidentally written myself into the corner as like the Lucas fan. I'm not a Lucas fan. And I think that those three make up like the kind of perfect trinity for if we're talking about like most influential living, if not always working directors currently.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm looking over my list. I'm like, this is a really white list. It's a white male list. I think we gotta, in the future, going forward, we need a little bit more diversity.
Mm. Yeah, but you know, I
don't want to open that can of worms exactly. Yeah,
maybe that's a discussion for another time.
But the sexism and racism is like so endemic. It's so firmly rooted in the industry that, like, I'm not sure what's going to fix it. But.
Yeah, but if you look at the winners of the DGA Awards last year, half of them were women in regards to, like, episodic television and so forth.
Right. So clearly the talent is there.
TV's and hopefully. Always been more female friendly.
Right.
And diversity as well.
Yeah. Right. So hopefully the film industry will catch up with the television industry. And when we revisit this topic, we will have scores of new people and more voices represented on our list. Okay, that's enough arguing over silly nonsense. It's time for our final notes of positivity. Carrie, what's one piece of culture, pop, or otherwise that you've been digging lately?
I will say the Renaissance Fair.
Okay.
They take place all during the year, all across the country, all the time. And one of the cool things I saw at the Renaissance Fair when I went a couple weekends ago, and it dawned on me, you see everybody on these different costumes, right? And it's like, well, it's just an excuse for people to put on costumes regardless of whether it's Renaissance themed or not. And then something dawned on me, and I was like, this is brilliant. There were people in all sorts of different time travel outfits.
All right.
And I was like, that's brilliant. I saw a Bill and Ted, right? I saw a Star Trek The Next Generation.
Nice.
Though that man should not have been wearing that outfit. A onesie on an overweight middle-aged man.
Oh,
it's
dear.
Not a good look.
Yeah.
And I saw what I thought was really, really brilliant was a Bruce Campbell in his in an outfit, you know, Army of Darkness.
Right.
Oh, my gosh, that was brilliant. And then, of course, I saw several different Doctor Whos. So I thought that every time I saw a different time travel character, I was like, oh, my gosh, that was brilliant that the person thought of that. How fun is that? So really, the Renaissance Fair kind of opens it up to whatever. You know, you see the steampunk people there, and you see – I saw some guy who looked like a caveman. I didn't get that. And I saw somebody – a couple people were dressed up in like British colonial.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, that doesn't make sense at all in Renaissance. But it, regardless, people were having fun. I thought, embrace that. And any opportunity that you can go out and wear, you know, your outfit that you have purchased and is a, you know, specialty to you. Can you imagine that people go, great, I get the opportunity to wear my Comic-Con outfit. And it's not Comic-Con.
Exactly.
You know, I just sat down and started people watching.
Yeah. So cosplay is your final note of positivity. I like it. You got anything?
Yes, now I got something.
Okay.
All right. This is going to be old news by the time this gets released. But I have no idea what the executives at ABC are on, but they went and like – renewed a bunch of shows that probably shouldn't have gotten renewed, and two of them I'm really excited about and I'm going to rewatch before they start. They renewed Agent Carter, which makes me really happy.
Yes, I heard about that recently. I'm
yes.
so excited.
Even though they're moving the second season to Los Angeles, but whatever, fine, cool, happy, because all I want for Christmas is a period piece that's just a misandrist period piece.
I love her. I love her.
Beating the crap out of. Also, follow Haley Atwell on Twitter. It's hilarious. It's absolutely fantastic. She's so funny. So they renewed Agent Carter and they renewed Gallivant, which is the musical half-hour fantasy renaissance-y strange show with songs by Alan Menken. And it was the weirdest little experiment. I honestly thought they weren't going to do anything with it because they kept burning off two episodes per Sunday. Mm-hmm. So it was like, why would they renew it? But they did, which means that we'll probably get more like random cameos. Like Weird Al Yankovic was in the last one playing a monk who had taken a vow of singing. So he had to sing everything he said. And
of course.
And rhymes like a real adventure with a real butt clencher. And like, it's ridiculous. I have watched it twice. I will watch it again. I suggest everyone do so as well if you just want something fluffy and bizarre to put on in the background.
Gallivant. Okay.
Gallivant. So Agent Carter and Gallivant are coming back, and that makes me happy.
Okay, so I'm going to cheat a little bit on mine. The third season of Orange is the New Black is coming out on June 12th. And I plan on dropping this episode shortly after that. We're recording before that date, so I can't vouch for the quality of the season. But by the time this podcast reaches your ears, I can guarantee you there will be nothing in my life that is making me as excited as having new episodes of that show to watch. I saw the trailer looks awesome. The Hot One's back. Lori Petty. The return of Lori Petty. We've all been waiting for it, right?
Tank girl.
I know. And there better be plenty of red. That's all I have to say. Mm-hmm. And what's the connection, huh?
Between Orange is the New Black and Taxi Driver?
Yes, there is one.
I'm at a loss.
Director?
Oh, Jodie Foster directed an episode.
Two episodes.
One of them was Emmy nominated.
Yes. And I have a non-cheat one as well. I'm listening to a new podcast, or I've discovered a podcast called The Sewers of Paris. It's hosted by Matt Baume. And each episode features a gay male guest, and he and Matt talk about the pop culture that made them who they are. And a lot of the stuff that made these guys who they are also... There's some overlap in some of our interests. One guy talked about Contact, speaking of Jodie Foster. But they also talk about camp.
As in summer camp? Or
no,
camp
like
as
campins
the...
and campiness.
Campiness.
Movie,
gotcha.
Like campy movies.
RuPaul.
So, yes, RuPaul. RuPaul gets mentioned from time to time on the show, as does Joan Crawford. And so as someone who... likes to record podcasts about Johnny Guitar. If you might be interested in listening to a podcast about Johnny Guitar, first check out our Johnny Guitar episode, and then check out The Sewers of Paris.
I'm ready with that.
Yeah. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, who do you think is the greatest living American director? Let us know on our website, flickswise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. You can find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Help us stand out in their massive database. Next podcast is another submission to the Flickswise favorites list. Load up on cans of Raid because it's bug killing time. Frequent Flixwiser Martin Kessler is going to tell us why he thinks Starship Troopers is one of the greatest movies of all time. That's right, Starship Troopers. I'm looking forward to that discussion. Until then, Carrie, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for sparring with me.
Anytime.
We didn't really spar this time, but...
Yeah, next time we got to get down to dirty
yeah, exactly. Anne-Marie, thanks for volunteering to play ref. Again, not necessary, but...
Always a pleasure.
We'll save the boxing metaphors for Raging Bull. Till then, take care, everyone.